Good morning. Welcome. I know most of you, but for those of you who don't, I'm the male half of the old father couple listed in the participants part. This is our third annual end of the year program, looking at deaths of that have occurred in the past year of prominent people, some of them, and some members of our own group. And we welcome you here. I call your attention to not a particularly good set of announcements in the newsletter, because those announcements encourage you to look elsewhere for the information, because I didn't have it at the time I did my Christmas gift to Sue and said, I'll do the order of service and you can take the week off. Well, anyway, but as the announcements say, there are places to learn more about what's going on. The newsletter for January is on a table in the narthex, and it contains about all the information I know about what things normally occur here during the course of next week and next week's, really. I do have one announcement to read from Jim Chanteau. He will host the first fellowship dinner of 2013 on Friday, July 11th at his house. There is. How about January? January. It's real small print in my defense here. At his house, there is a sign-up sheet in the narthex, the message says. Old and especially new. Shall we say veteran? UUs rather than old. And its new ones are invited to join fellow UUs for good food and enjoyable conversation. These potluck dinners have been a long tradition at UUFM, and it's a great way to get to know other UUs. And for information, you may get in touch with either Ann Jim Chanteau or Ann Marchand, who co-chair the program. And my guess is contact information is available there in the newsletter. All right, let's move to the chalice lighting. Kathleen lights it. I want to read a bit from a Mary Oliver poem, When Death Comes. I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular. And I think of each name, a comfortable music in the mouth, tending as all music towards silence. And each body, a lion of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. Did it work? No. Well, that's been a common affliction here. If it works, fine. If it doesn't. If my crew of helpers will come forward and we will... You can turn to the opening hymn, which is 396, a round that is often used in memorial services, in services like this one. I thought it might fit nicely. All right. We're here, but we'll sing together. Maybe we'll work better.
I know this rose will open, I know my fear will burn away, I know my soul will unfurl its wings, I know this rose will open.
Sing with us, is it okay?
I know this rose will open, I know my fear will burn away, I know my soul will unfurl its wings. I know this rose will open.
All right, we need to, let's see. I'll take this group right here. Dick, why don't you take that room in the back, the three or four rows there. And the two of you, why don't you divide up that over there some way. And we'll do it as a round. Ready? We'll lead. And it comes up. I'll one, two, three, four.
I know this rose will open. So I know this rose will open.
Where does it break here?
Will.
After will.
I know this rose. I know this rose. I know this rose. I know this rose will open. I know my fears will turn away. I know my soul will firm its wings. I know this rose will open. I know this rose will open. I know.
Well, here's what I want to do. Kids, why don't you come up and sit about here? There would be enough room for you up here. Kids, come on up. And we're going to need the microphone to be passed because what we're going to do is this. We're going to have an audience participation in this, and we're going to talk about the best gifts that you got for Christmas. So if you want to think, not long, just very shortly, the best gift you ever got for Christmas that you can share publicly that would be what you might do. And I will start. I will tell you that the year I was 7, I got what I had fervently hoped for and hoped dearly that Santa Claus would find, and that was a pair of cowboy boots in my size. They fit perfectly, and I was really glad to have a new pair of cowboy boots. Okay, who's next? Who's got a gift? No, you and then we'll get them last. They get to go last. Who's got a gift to tell about?
We have a very dry environment, so our procedure today is I'm going to kind of touch you before I hand you the mic so we don't blow the mic.
My best gifts were not from Santa Claus, but two children, because both of my children were born right before Christmas and had some complications, but they were both healthy, so I consider that my best Christmas gift.
I got shoe roller skates for Christmas one year when I was in high school. We just had a new roller rink built, and I never thought my folks would get them.
Mickey Ray. When I was 5, I got a suitcase, and I've been traveling ever since.
This is the best one I can remember. Last year, my husband did some research on my family and found out my great-great-great-grandmother had my exact name, Sylvia Kale, and she was a Tuscarora Indian.
Oh, wow.
I think I was about 8, and it was my summertime birthday, and got a... that wasn't Christmas, was it? No. Well, it was my birthday. I'm sorry. And I got a red balloon-tired bicycle, and I was delighted.
Oh, you got one, too? Okay.
My first Christmas was after I was married and had 3 children. We lived in New York, and Carl went out the day before Christmas and found a tree. And it was my first Christmas tree ever. Because until then, as I was growing up, it was always Hanukkah. I had wonderful gifts, but I always wanted a Christmas tree, and I got one finally.
Okay, I know you're here, but...
No, that's okay. No?
Not hard. He said, touch you, not hard.
Hi, Anna Franklin. Well, I think the year I was 10... was the year that I had a wonderful Christmas because I guess I realized that there was one person in the world that really understood me, and that was my mom. And the reason I realized that was that for I don't know how long she had been sewing on this and putting everything away and hiding it from me when I got home from school. But when Christmas came, there was a box with a beautifully hand-tailored, deep... rich jewel-toned corduroy bathrobe in an oriental style just for me, and was made just for me by my mom. So that was the very, very best gift I ever got that I can remember.
Well, maybe it'd be a good time to find out about your Christmas presents that you like so much. Okay. So remember, when I hand it to you, I have to touch you first so that we don't short out the mic. So who got a good Christmas present that you want to tell about? How about you? Okay. You tell me. You tell us.
I got something that you could, like, put hair things in. It's something like, I have a light-up necklace, and I put it on there, and it like, lights up in the dark.
Oh, wow. Sounds like a great present. Did you get a present you want to tell about?
I got a present from my mom that I pretty much bought, but but it was lights and it was awesome.
Oh, good. All right. How about you, Jake?
You know what kind of present I got? I got a camera and a trumpet and a yo-yo.
Wow.
I got something else, and I got everything else that I didn't ask for Christmas.
Well, good for you. All right. How about you, Nick?
My grandfather got me a bunch of tools for my toolbox.
All right. Okay.
same as Nick. And we went to our neighbor's house for, like, this dinner, and then they brought some presents for me. I got this thing you can't get anymore. It's an Erector Space Patrol alien ship that you can build. And now that I have some tools, I can. It's going to help me a little bit to build the Erector.
Okay, cool. Now, for next year, let's plan ahead. And next year, what I want all of you to be able to tell us was the best Christmas gift you ever gave. We'll try it that way next year. You already have that? Well, you're not going to be here next year, right? So you can tell us now.
I got my mom some earrings.
Oh, cool. All right. Okay. So he's off. The rest of you, you've got a year to think about this. All right. Well, we'll send you off now. Go now. Everywhere you may go. I believe you're next. Thanks for helping. Yeah.
Morning. We lost three of our members of the fellowship this year: Doris Grosch, June Kermser, and Philip Kermser, all with this summer, June and July. Doris was 87, June was 91, and Phil was 92. The Kermsers were founding members of this fellowship in the 50s, and Doris Grosch was a longtime on and off member. But ultimately, she attended a lot towards the end of her life and really enjoyed it here. All three of these special people left large footprints in the sand of life, As I compared these three lives and re-listened to their memorials, which I appreciated being able to do, I found some common values. Each valued education, the arts, a worldview, equality, and service to humanity. All three had the highest respect for education. I believe they had at least 8 college degrees between them, 2 of them PhDs. They believed, to my mind, in the power of education to transform a life and transform the world. Knowledge was power to them. Knowledge was freedom. And I'm sure they believed that education should be made available to all people in the whole world. Doris Grosch earned her PhD in statistics after 13 years as a stay-at-home mom. She joined the Department of Industrial Engineering, becoming the first woman faculty member in the College of Engineering. June Kermser had a master's in English, joined the Navy, and practiced social work in a poor area of Washington, D.C. Philip Kermser completed a PhD in math, was a professor of mechanical engineering at KSU for 42 years. This career of his came after serving in the Navy during World War II on a mechanical engineering team performing tests on America's first atomic bomb. Well, education for them went beyond their individual disciplines. It carried over into language, poetry, literature, music, and the arts. Phil Kermser was described as an accomplished classical musician, playing piano, flute, and oboe. He played with a flute trio group in Manhattan, which played for his memorial and remembered how supportive he was to the group. He had a love of languages, learning German, French, Russian, and Chinese. He pursued these passions until the end of his life, asking his daughter to bring language books to Meadowlark so he could brush up on his grammar, and working with Elke Lorenz to work out some problems he was having with the German he was reading. June and Phil Kermser traveled extensively for work and play. Their overseas experiences are too numerous to mention, particularly for Phil, who did lots of professional activities around the world. But I think it exhibits their interest in the whole world, and they saw themselves as part of the whole, of all humanity. They opened their home to many international students and their families and maintained ties to these individuals until their deaths. Several of these former students wrote tributes to them that were read at their memorials. This openness to other cultures and people carried through in their actions and made them fierce defenders of equality and fairness. Several stories exist of June Kermser defending the rights of African Americans in Manhattan, including one drugstore counter incident where the store would not serve her black friend, and June stood up and said, "Well, if you won't serve her, you won't serve me," and walked out. Doris Grosch loved teaching math to her children and loved taking her children on factory tours wherever and whenever they traveled. Throughout her career, she taught new courses frequently, teaching herself new material in order to be able to teach it to others. And after she retired, she wrote a textbook, Linear Programming for Beginners, still used today. This book was always sitting at her, near her bedside at Meadowlark. All three of these members believed in giving back to our community to encourage education and arts. Doris Grosch is remembered for her work as a fierce supporter of arts in Manhattan. She and her husband, Gene, made great contributions of time and money. And I don't think the Art Center would exist in its current form without the Grosches. She also worked hard for League of Women Voters and Democratic Party. She learned computer programs to maintain their databases and learned how to build websites, again, long after retirement, even as macular degeneration was stealing her vision. I remember visiting her one time at Meadowlark and seeing her 54-inch computer monitor and another machine, kind of like a microfiche machine, that would blow up documents so she could read things that came in. She just kept getting the newest technology to see. June Kermser is best remembered for attending Manhattan Ogden School Board meetings for 53 years, representing all of us, public.
She was instrumental in getting school social work established in Manhattan. It was obvious at her memorial that she was a sounding board and an advice giver to many school board members through the years. Many remembered her fondly and spoke about her at her memorial, really appreciated her role. So all three of these incredible people were also wives, husband, mothers, and father. Doris Grosch was married to Jean Grosch for over 50 years. They had three daughters, Kathy, Barbara, and Margaret. June and Phil Kermser grew up in the same neighborhood in St. Paul, Minnesota, carpooled to college at the University of Minnesota, married, and were just 8 days shy of their 70th anniversary. They adopted a boy and a girl, Larry and Sandy, when the children were 10 and 5. Their children both spoke so eloquently about how lucky they were to be raised by these parents. I have only scratched the surface of these remarkable people, June, Philip, and Doris. They helped create this fellowship we are now enjoying, just as we are now supporting it, strengthening it, caring for it, for those that will come after us. We were darn lucky they were here for us, for our children, for our world, and may their legacies encourage us to do more and be better human beings.
I'm reading from an essay titled Death from the book Letters to My Son, Reflections on Becoming a Man by Kent Nerburn. Death is our common mystery. Like birth and love, it is a bond that unites us all. Yet none of us can know for certain what it contains or what it portends. Everyone must meet death alone, so it remains the great private preparation for each of us. Once many years ago, I was present at a total eclipse of the sun. I had climbed to the top of a high hill and had sat down to wait. It was early morning, slightly past sunup. Birds were singing in the trees around me. Far below on a hillside, cows were grazing and horses rustled in the tall grasses. When the moment came, the sun began to darken. The horses were silent and the earth stood still. The cows sank to their knees, and the birds placed their heads beneath their wings. Only the ghostly corona of the hidden sun remained to cast a fragile light on the enveloping darkness. There was no wind. There was no sound. The light of the sun had been taken from us, and the world was cast into darkness. In that brief moment when I stood on that hillside while the earth's light went out, I felt no indifference and no sense of loss. Instead, I felt an unutterable sense of gain, a shattering of all my own boundaries into a vast, vast sense of peace. I cannot put a name to the knowledge I gained at that moment. It was too far beyond the human for me to understand. But I know it had to do with death, and I know it had to do with that great darkness into which we all must go. In that moment on the hillside, if that moment on the hillside contained truth, and I think it did, we do death no justice by measuring it against ourselves. We are too small, it is too great. So, fear dying if you must. It takes from us the only life that we can understand, and it is a worthy loss to mourn. It is something too great to celebrate, too great to fear. We should embrace our dying as a momentary passage into the great harmony of eternity. Perhaps we cannot hear that harmony now. Perhaps we even hear it as a vast and empty silence. But we should not be deceived. The vastness is not empty. It has a presence. Even in the greatest places, the silence has a sound. We will pass the plates now to support this church and its members. Every year, I indulge my interest in people's lives by reading many of the obituaries in the New York Times. I look every couple of days to keep track of things, and I've met some very interesting and unusual and people along the way, and occasionally found myself reading a book written by that person or about him because of interest that I sparked by hearing about his or her life. And I photocopy several of these, runoff copies of several of these, and keep a stack. And toward the end of the year, I begin to find out who will be in town on this date, and ask them to do an obituary, give them a stack of some that I think might fit their personalities. One of them was Bryce Hobrock, and Bryce was all prepared to do one this morning, but he's snowed in all of all places, Buffalo, New York, and where they know something about snow. I've included in the insert on either the front or the back, in addition to the words that we will sing for our closing hymn, I've included the names of a bunch of these people, no particular order or of prominence or anything else, just folks that died during the year. And if we have time during the period following Matt Sayers' presentation, his name is in there twice, spelled different ways, but Sayers is the right way. We will, if we have some time, if somebody wants to say something as in a part to about one of those people briefly, that would be the time we would do that. And now we'll begin with Eleanor Ostrom.
Eleanor Ostrom, who died of pancreatic cancer at the age of 78 this summer, was the first and so far only woman to win the Nobel Prize for Economics. She received the award, shared with Oliver E. Williamson, in 2009 for her analysis of how individuals and communities can often manage common resources, ranging from irrigation and fisheries to information systems, as well as or better than markets, companies, or the state. Earlier this year, she appeared on Time magazine's list of the 100 most influential people in the world. It's notable that Ostrom won the Nobel Prize in Economics because she was a trained political scientist, not an economist, and her work was considered outside of the mainstream. She started her career by focusing on groundwater resources in the Los Angeles basin, then studied neighborhood policing in Indianapolis. Lynn, as her friends called her, then turned her attention to the subject that gained her worldwide recognition, how the overexploitation of unowned or commonly owned resources could be averted by collective action by local users. Lynn was born in 1933 in Los Angeles and was an only child. Her family was very poor, especially after her father left when she was young, leaving her mother a single parent. She often spoke about how growing up in the Depression had influenced her interest in cooperative institutions. She recalled helping her family grow food in a large garden and knitting scarves for soldiers. Lynn received her bachelor's, master's, and PhD from UCLA in political science, completing her studies in 1965. At a time when it was still rare for women to hold advanced degrees, let alone tenured positions, she moved with her husband, the political theorist Vincent Ostrom, to Bloomington, Indiana, where Lynn was initially hired as a visiting assistant professor at Indiana University. The couple remained at the university for the rest of their long and productive careers. In 1973, the Ostroms co-founded a research and teaching center, the Workshop in Political Theory and Policy Analysis, where academics could engage in collaborative and interdisciplinary learning and scholarship. The couple evolved a distinct Bloomington School of Political Economy, premised on notions of polycentric governance that Vincent had pioneered in the early 1960s. Polycentric systems involve resource management at multiple levels. The notion remained a constant feature of Lynn's work throughout her career, including recent contributions to climate change literature. Lynn received a dozen honorary doctorates from universities from Harvard to Uppsala, and more than two dozen awards and prizes for academic and professional organizations. She served as president of the American Political Science Association, the International Association for the Study of Common Property, and the Public Choice Society, and was on the executive boards of committees of dozens of professional organizations, including the National Science Foundation, the Max Planck Institute, the National Research Council, the MacArthur Foundation, and the Stockholm Resilience Center. She sat on editorial boards of nearly two dozen journals. Lynn was an intensely private and modest person who was taken aback and sometimes embarrassed by the attention she received towards the end of her career. To her, accolades took a back seat to the work, which was always, in her mind, a collaborative enterprise. It was not out of false modesty that she often referred to her Nobel Prize as the workshop's prize. In reading about Dr. Ostrom and her work, I found that I really liked the tribute that the magazine The Economist gave to her, and I would like to read that for you now, because I think it gives you a sense of her personality. It seemed to Eleanor Ostrom that the world contained a large body of common sense. People, left to themselves, would sort out rational ways of surviving and getting along. Although the world's arable land, forest, fresh water, and fisheries were all finite, it was possible to share them without depleting them and to care for them without fighting. While others wrote gloomily of the tragedy of the commons, seeing only overfishing and overfarming in a free-for-all of greed, Mrs. Ostrom, with her loud laugh and louder tops, cut a cheery and contrarian figure. Years of fieldwork, by herself and others, had shown her that humans were not trapped and helpless amid diminishing supplies. She had looked at forests in Nepal, irrigation systems in Spain, mountain villages in Switzerland and Japan, fisheries in Maine and Indonesia. She had even, as part of her PhD at the University of California, Los Angeles, studied the water wars and pumping races going on in the 1950s in her own dry backyard. All these cases had taught her that, over time, human beings tended to draw up sensible rules for the use of common pool resources. Neighbors set boundaries and assigned shares, with each individual taking in turn to use water or to graze cows on a certain meadow. Common tasks, such as clearing canals or cutting timber, were done together at a certain time. Monitors watched out for rule breakers, fining or eventually excluding them. The schemes were mutual and reciprocal, and many had worked well for centuries. Best of all, they were not imposed from above. Mrs. Ostrom put no faith in governments, nor in large conservation schemes paid for with aid money and crawling with concrete-bearing engineers. Polycentrism was her ideal. Caring for the commons had to be a multiple task, organized from the ground up and shaped to cultural norms. It had to be discussed face-to-face and based on trust. Mrs. Ostrom, besides poring over satellite data and quizzing lobstermen herself, enjoyed employing game theory to try to predict the behavior of people faced with limited resources. In her workshop in political theory and policy analysis at Indiana University, set up with her husband Vincent, a political scientist, in 1973, her students were given shares in a notional commons. When they simply discussed what they should do before they did it, their rate of return from their investments more than doubled. "Small is beautiful," sometimes seemed to be her creed. Her workshop looked somewhat like a large cluttered cottage, reflecting her and Vincent's idea that science was a form of artisanship. When the vogue in America was all for consolidation of public services, she ran against it. For some years, she compared police forces in the town of Speedway and the city of Indianapolis, finding that forces of 25 to 50 officers performed better by almost every measure than 100-strong metropolitan teams. But smaller institutions, she cautioned, might not work better in every case. As she traveled the world, giving out good and sharp advice, "No panaceas," was her cry. Rather than littleness, collaboration was her watchword. Neighbors thrived if they worked together. The best-laid communal schemes would fall apart once people began to act only as individuals or formed elites. Born poor herself to a jobless film set maker in Los Angeles who soon left her mother alone, she despaired of people who wanted only a grand house or a fancy car. Her childhood world was colored by digging a wartime victory vegetable garden, knitting scarves for the troops, buying her clothes in a charity store. Mutual efforts to a mutual end. The same approach was valuable in academia, too. Her own field, institutional economics, or the study of social dilemmas, as she thought of it, straddled political science, ecology, psychology, and anthropology. She liked to learn from all of them, marching boldly across the demarcation lines to hammer out good policy. And she welcomed workshop partners from any discipline, singing folk songs with them too, if anyone had a guitar. They were family. Pure economists looked askance at this perky, untidy figure, especially when she became the first woman to win a shared Nobel Prize for Economics in 2009. She was not put out. It was the workshop's prize anyway, she said, and the money would go for scholarships. Yet the incident shed a keen light on one particular sort of collaboration, that between men and women. Lynn, as everyone called her, and Vincent, both much-honored professors, were joint stars of their university in old age. But she had been dissuaded from studying economics at UCLA because, being a girl, she had been steered away from math at high school. And she was dissuaded from doing political science because, being a girl, she could not hope for a good university post. As a graduate, she had been offered only secretarial jobs, and her first post at Indiana involved teaching a 7:30 a.m. class in government that no one else would take. There was, she believed, a great common fund of sense and wisdom in the world, but it had been an uphill struggle to show that it reposed in both women and men, and that humanity would do best if it could exploit it to the fullest.
Phyllis Diller died this past August at the age of 95. Fortunately for us, she had a few loose ends that she hasn't finished up yet, and she hasn't yet departed for the great beyond. And she's agreed very graciously to spend a few minutes with us this morning. Ms. Diller?
Oh. Sorry I'm late. I had a little fender bender on the corner of Points in Colorado.
But Ms. Diller... Points in Colorado don't cross.
They do now.
Well, in any case, I'm very glad that you were able to make it here, and I must say you're looking very lovely today.
You got to be kidding. When I was born, I was so ugly, the doctor slapped my mother. When I was 3 years old, my parents sent me out to buy some bubble gum. While I was gone, they moved away. When I go to the beach wearing my bikini, even the tide won't come in.
I must say you look very youthful for a woman of 95.
Hey, buddy, get some new glasses. Well, when you're 95, you start forgetting things.
You look very lovely.
I spent 6 hours in the beauty shop yesterday. That was just for the estimate. I'm on the 14th year of a 10-day beauty plan. I'm so old, they discontinued my blood type. You know you're really old when someone tells you they like your alligator shoes and you're barefoot.
Ms. Diller, your hair looks very lovely.
This isn't hair. These are nerve endings.
Would you say you're a woman of nervous disposition?
Well, maybe, but tranquilizers help a lot. You know, they really work if you just follow the directions on the label. Keep away from children.
Ms. Diller, maybe you could say a couple of words about your husband, Fang.
Oh, sure. Sure I could. How about cheap and lazy? Yeah, Fang wasn't the brightest light bulb in the chandelier. One time he got stranded for 6 hours on a broken escalator. Another time he was in the mall and looked at the map that said, "You are here." He couldn't even figure out how they knew that. I knew my marriage was in trouble on my first anniversary. Fang gave me a set of luggage.
Luggage seems like an appropriate gift.
It was packed.
Oh,
my mother
I see.
Damn well almost smothered in there.
Oh, well. Well, anyway, it must have been quite a wrenching change becoming a stand-up comedian after raising 5 children and being a homemaker and housewife.
It was a relief, believe me. I never could get the hang of housework. You know, Fang, my husband Fang always said, housework, doing housework never killed anybody. But I always said, why take a chance? However, after many years, I did figure out why my neighbor's laundry was much whiter than mine. She washed it.
Well, in any case, Ms. Diller, you've had a wonderful and successful career.
Ha! Guess he could say that. I never made Who's Who, but it was featured in What's That?
Yes. Thanks very much for stopping by, and we certainly hope to see you again sometime.
Oh, I hope so, too. And that's interesting. As a lifelong atheist, you know, I never have believed in heaven and hell and all that stuff. And I've been dead for 3 months. What the heck am I doing here?
Well, that was Phyllis Diller. Phyllis Diller was a small-town housewife from Ohio, mother of 5 children. with a frequently unemployed husband until she was pushing 40 years of age. And then over the next 10 years, through talent, willpower, and indomitable spirit, seemingly insurmountable odds, and in spite of the discouragement of most of her friends, she became the first woman to fully inhabit the man's world of solo stand-up comedy. My mother's generation was the last generation where most women were full-time stay-at-home moms and homemakers, and Phyllis Diller was one of those women until she was almost 40. Before taking her brave leap towards self-realization in her late 30s, she was just another mother and housewife, known for her sharp wit, the life of the party at garden clubs, bridge groups, and parent-teacher meetings. And when she finally and belatedly embarked on a career in comedy, her stage persona became the severely fashion-challenged suburban housewife, and her stock subjects for humor were unmanageable children, her own lousy cooking and housekeeping, difficult mothers-in-law, and the mishaps of her fictitious husband, Fang. Phyllis Diller was a woman that many women of my mother's generation could strongly identify with. She was someone just like them, except that she actually did what many of them possibly only dreamed of doing, and that was realized her personal ambition beyond the role of family caretaker. Phyllis Diller and my mother were born within a few months of each other, Phyllis in August of 1917, my mother in January of 1918, and I grew up regarding Phyllis Diller as a slightly altered version of my own mother, and so did many others of my generation. Her humor, like my mother's, was self-deprecating. Phyllis Diller used to say that her comedy started out with self-denigration and then shifted smoothly to the denigration of everybody else. Those others were usually the fictitious family of her stage persona, and she was laughing at a caricature of herself as well as at the human condition. She truly believed that laughter is the best medicine. During one stage of her career, Phyllis Diller employed a housewife from Wisconsin named Mary McBride to write many of her jokes. My own mother was also a housewife from Wisconsin and could easily have filled the same role, as could thousands of others of women of that time. My mother had some stock jokes that she often repeated that Phyllis Diller definitely would have used in her sticks if she'd heard them. As I mentioned, my mother, like Phyllis Diller, often made fun of her own inadequacies as a housewife, and she used to say that the rule in her kitchen was to avoid any recipe that had more than two ingredients. She also said that Bisquick was one of the most versatile items in her pantry, with applications in cooking, cosmetics, and construction. You could use it to make pancakes, smooth wrinkles, or pour sidewalks. When Phyllis Diller was still a full-time housewife, and at a time when she was still merely the funniest woman in the church circle, her husband was one of the few who gave her unwavering encouragement to try to become a professional comedian, possibly in part because he periodically found himself unemployed and the family needed a steady income. Phyllis Diller always said that she lacked the self-confidence to make the leap into professional stand-up comedy until she read a self-help book entitled The Magic of Believing by Claude Bristol. Bristol was referring to believing in yourself, not believing in God. Inspired by its message of self-empowerment without the crutch of religion, Phyllis Diller began to write her own comedy routines, took whatever paid or unpaid performing jobs she could get at hospitals, women's clubs, church halls, well before her career took off. And for the rest of her life, she unashamedly and unapologetically credited this book, The Magic of Believing, for giving her the strength to listen to her own inner voice and to develop an immunity to any external voices of discouragement, of which there were many. She made clear that her belief that we do not need a God to deign to grant us strength and purposefulness, that we have it within ourselves and we can decide to mobilize these powers using our own mental and spiritual resources. Her philosophy of living can be summed up in three words: kindness, optimism, and self-respect. Treat everyone with kindness and respect, not just those who can do you favors. Always be optimistic and positive, and work to be the best you can be. Don't try to be anybody else. Don't try to be guided, or don't be guided by someone else's vision of what they think you should be. She lived that philosophy. She saw her mission in life as lifting the spirits of everyone she came in contact with. Laughter is the best medicine, and Phyllis Diller dispensed it liberally to all her patients.
There was quite a bit of competition for who would get to follow that. And I won. Here's George McGovern's CV. Born in Avon, South Dakota, father a Methodist minister. Education, bachelor's at Dakota Wesleyan University, MA and PhD in history at Northwestern. His dissertation topic was labor militancy during the Colorado Coalfield War of 1913 to 14. Military service from 1942 to 45, where he flew 35 missions as the pilot of a B-24 bomber in the European theater. His employment history, briefly as a professor of history and political science at Dakota Wesleyan, and then executive director of the South Dakota Democratic Party, which wasn't much, from 1953 to 56. As an elected official, he served in the U.S. House of Representatives for two terms, from 1957 to 61, and in the U.S. Senate for three terms, from 1963 through 1981. His government service involved being the head of the U.S. Food and Peace Program in 1961 and 2. And then from 1997 to 2001, he was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization in Rome. His many honors include two important ones, especially. One is the Distinguished Flying Cross, went along with his service in valiant service, really, in Europe during World War II, and late in life, the Presidential Medal of Honor in 2000. I chose George McGovern to remember not only because he was the only person I'd actually met who was included in the 1,000 or so obituaries in the Times this year. Much more importantly, it was his knack for giving plain-spoken yet eloquent voice to my own beliefs and for his tireless efforts to turn those same beliefs into public policy. And I was fortunate to play a very, very small role in those efforts. In 1968, as a graduate student at the University of Nebraska, I served as president of the Nebraska Concerned Democrats, the Dump Johnson Bunch, a branch of the national organization that was trying to replace Lyndon Johnson as the party's standard bearer. After Bobby Kennedy, Frank Church, and George McGovern turned down the offers from the Peace Democrats, Gene McCarthy became the anti-Vietnam War candidate. After Kennedy's assassination and McGovern's agreement to seek the nomination, I was part of a group that tried to convince the 25 or so Nebraska Kennedy delegates to support McGovern. National efforts to that same end were dignified and spirited, but establishment forces prevailed and the party settled on Vice President Hubert Humphrey. The National Party, as a concession to anti-war Democrats and increasingly vocal feminists in the party, established a commission to rewrite delegate selection procedures in order to make them more inclusive, and McGovern was asked to serve as its chair. Once the National Commission had done its work, every state was required to establish a mini-McGovern commission to bring its delegate selection process into alignment with the new National Party rules. By early 1971, when this process got underway in Kansas, I had moved here and been elected to a minor, very minor, position in the state Democratic Party. I volunteered to serve on that commission and had the pleasure of getting to know and admire its most influential member, Professor Lew Douglas of Kansas State. We hammered out the procedures, which for the most part still guide how delegates are selected to Democratic conventions from Kansas. The impact of the national and state McGovern commissions was nothing short of revolutionary. Prior to 1972, virtually all delegates to Democratic conventions were middle-aged, white, and mostly male. Beginning that year, however, things changed dramatically in all states, as all states' delegations risked being unseated at the convention unless their delegates were evenly divided by gender and inclusive of minorities and younger voters. Because McGovern himself and his young supporters and advisors understood and exploited their knowledge of the new rules so much more effectively than the opposition, they locked down the nomination fairly early in the campaign. Parenthetically, their methods provided the model and the playbook for Obama's improbable success in 2008. In the process, many Democrats in virtually every state who had expected to continue attending national conventions failed to become delegates because they wouldn't endorse McGovern. Their bitterness contributed to his defeat in the fall, but that's only a small part of the story, as I'm sure most of you know, and I won't tell it. Here's a sidebar. Shortly after I moved to South Dakota in 1975, I met the senator in a Sioux Falls hotel lobby. Following a short pause after I introduced myself, he said, "You led the caucus for me in western Kansas in 1972, didn't you?" During several subsequent meetings, South Dakota's even smaller than Kansas, he never failed to acknowledge that connection. For many people, his defeat as the Democratic candidate for president in 1972 is remembered principally for being one of the most decisive in U.S. history. For me, however, my involvement remains a badge of honor. And to that point, I want to read two brief excerpts from campaign speeches that year, which provide some insight into George McGovern's character. In his acceptance speech, which nobody heard because it occurred at 3 o'clock in the morning, at the nominating convention, he said this: "We reject the view of those who say America, love it or leave it. To them we reply, let us change it so that we love it more." At fundamentalist Wheaton College in Illinois, McGovern called upon his audience to grieve not only for American casualties in Vietnam, but also for the Vietnamese lives lost to American military actions. He insisted that Americans confront their own responsibility for the consequences of war and, quote, "change those things in our character which turned us astray, away from the truth that the people of Vietnam are like us, the children of God." Finally, I want to quote from McGovern's 2007 book, the last of several he wrote. The title is What It Means to Be a Democrat. That's why I'm a Democrat. "We are the party that believes we cannot let the strong kick aside the weak. Our party believes that poor children should be as well educated as those from wealthy families. We believe that everyone should pay their fair share of taxes and that everyone should have access to health care." He was not just a loser. Matt.
Good morning. I'd like to tell the story from the perspective of a little boy who, like millions of other children just like him, learned something about numbers and counting from a singing vampire. Jerry Nelson was born in 1934 and picked up puppeteering as a way to make ends meet until a film or stage career presented itself. His big break came when Frank Oz was drafted for Vietnam. Jim Henson needed a new puppeteer to assist with the operation of Rolf the dog on the Jimmy Dean show. Oz actually failed his physical after his draft, but decided to take some time off, allowing Nelson to keep his new job. Thus began a productive working relationship that solidified in 1969 with the introduction of Sesame Street. He worked on a number of memorable characters, but is best remembered for Count Von Count, whose Erythromania and Romani musical numbers taught children that math games could be fun. Some of his other characters included Harry Monster, Mumford the Magician, who cast all his spells by saying, "a la peanut butter sandwiches," and Sherlock Hemlock, the world's greatest detective, who more often than not actually committed the crime that he was actually investigating. He was brought on board by Henson for a new ambitious project, The Muppet Show. The Muppet Show allowed Nelson to showcase both his versatility as a puppeteer and his musical talents. In addition to his regular characters, including Floyd, the guitarist of the band The Electric Teeth, and Kermit the Frog's nephew, Robin, when the show needed a fill-in role or a one-off character, Nelson was the go-to guy. He played well over 100 different characters on both Sesame Street and The Muppet Show. But during Nelson's tenure on The Muppet Show, his participation was actually limited by his daughter's illness with cystic fibrosis. In a move characteristic of Jim Henson, he gave her a brief speaking part in the first Muppet movie so that she could be in the Actors Guild. She died in 1982. After his daughter's death, Nelson was given lead puppeteering duties on another new Henson project Fraggle Rock. Fraggle Rock illustrated the idea that both individuals and societies are interconnected and dependent on one another. Life between the different species in the cave were symbiotic, and imbalance in one led to chaos in all of the others. Nelson performed Gobo Fraggle, as well as several other members of the ensemble cast, including the Father Gorg and the Mystic Trash Heap. Following Fraggle Rock, he was a participant in almost all the long-term projects Henson created and set in motion. And even as he aged and stepped back from active puppeteering, he continued his provide voice work on his primary characters up until the time of his death from emphysema earlier this year. In conclusion, please remember that infinite whimsy and endless wonder require commensurate effort to produce. Jerry Nelson exercised Herculean efforts in six separate decades to bring them to us.
Well, we have a little time. I have some experience working with this group and know that it's a little bit like herding cats, and you may or may not wish to follow my suggestion during the discussion portion of it, but here it is. I'll make it again. If some of those one of those names on that list of the people who have died this year is somebody who had some important things to say to you, or somebody who died this year who isn't on that list, the floor is now open for that or whatever else you might want to do for the next 10 minutes or so. Oh, Pat, right.
I got another one first.
Okay. Ms. Springbaker, I never knew much about George Montgomery because I think he was a bit before my time, but I enjoyed the presentation, and I'll probably buy one of his books to see what more. I mean, if you recommend any good book by him, I'll read it. But you know, thank you for presenting George Montgomery. Good, thank you. There you go.
Pat Embers, I looked through this list, which is really great, and my eyes really stopped at Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau. When I lived in Germany in the 60s, and that's where I took up voice lessons, and he was just the greatest, and I got to hear him in concert in Berlin at their famous hall there. But anyway, it's just an astounding person and a great singer, and I just am glad that he is in this program, and I'm sorry that he's gone.
And not a tenor.
And not
but a baritone.
Yeah. Really. Yeah.
When I was a Middle East editor at National Geographic, I had the joy of working on many stories with Andrew Coburn. And it was his brother, Alexander, who passed away this year. And I never met Alex, but hearing lots of stories from Andrew about their exploits in the Middle East and interviewing Saddam Hussein's sons and various adventures that they had with dictators and rebel groups in the Middle East were quite entertaining and informative. And so I think he's going to be a voice for politics, so it'll be missed.
Phyllis Diller was my role model. I think the first time I saw her, I was in college and went to visit my grandmother in Cleveland, and my aunt and uncle took me to see her, and I just thought, oh my God, that's so wonderful. People criticized her for possibly not being a good mother because she was a working mother, and she said, oh no, she always participated in whatever was going on at school. And when the children had a birthday, she always made a cupcake for them to take to school. And the other woman said, a cupcake? Why not a cake? She said, well, I never clean the oven, and so a cupcake is all that'll fit in there. So Every time I clean the oven, I think about her.
I'm looking at this list, and there are so many that have that I know or have touched my life or whose books I've read. But I look down here and see Marvin Hamlisch, who was one of the most magnificent musicians and composers of musicals. And I think he will be very missed.
While the microphone is making its way around, I want to read a poem that I discovered on the way and couldn't find a way to fit in, but here's some blank space. It's called Authorship by James Ball Naylor. King David and King Solomon led merry, merry lives with many, many lady friends and many, many wives. But when old age crept up on them with many, many qualms, King Solomon wrote the Proverbs and King David wrote the Psalms. Anybody else?
Yeah, you know, there's just such an incredible list of artists, musicians. Did anybody else hear Earl Scruggs when he played here in Manhattan at Ahern Fieldhouse? Yeah. It was probably about 69 or 70, or maybe 71, but that was pretty incredible to hear him live. And also Ravi Shankar, I got to hear in the London Coliseum, and, you know, they just change your life. Thanks.
Is there another hand up over here?
As you say, wonderful names, but Dave Brubeck popped out. Bernd and I enjoyed his jazz so much. It was just a wonderful jazz musician and just great joy.
Just wanted to say a quick word about Maurice Sendak, who was always one of my favorite children's author when I was a child, and whose books are part of the staple of the books I read to my own kids. He always had a way of puncturing and thinking outside the box, playing on appearances and ideas to get to what was important.
Well, let's move to the closing hymn. Dick's going to come up and help me lead it. I've got a bigger print for you, if that would be helpful. You want to stand as you're able, and we'll sing Pete Seeger's hymn.
To everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to reap, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to laugh, a time to weep. To everything turn, 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 there is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to build up, a time to break down, a time to dance, a time to mourn, a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together. To everything turn, 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 there is a season. Turn, 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 and a time for every purpose under heaven. A time of war, a time of peace, a time of love, a time of hate, a time you may embrace, a time to refrain from embracing. To everything, turn, turn. a season, turn, 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 and a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to gain, a time to lose, a time to rend, a time to sow, a time to love, a time to hate, a time of peace. I swear it's not too late. To everything, turn, 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 there is a season, turn, 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 and a time for every purpose under heaven.
Closing words from Mark Morrison Reed. What we need to fear is not death, but squandering the lives we have been miraculously given. So let me die laughing, savoring one of life's crazy moments. Let me die holding the hand of one I love and recalling that I tried to love and was loved in return. Let me die remembering that life has been good and that I did everything I could. But today, just remind me that I am dying so that I can live, savor, and love with all my heart. Break. Thank you.